Okay, we heard the Boogie Stop Shuffle, and that was Charles Mingus on bass and Danny Richmond on drums. Danny Richmond is on the telephone with me now. He's going to speak to us from his home in Greensville, North Carolina. He played with Charles Mingus for a long period of time, from 1957 till the time Mingus retired from music, so he'll be talking to us about some of his remembrances of Charles Mingus. Danny Richmond, welcome to Fresh Air, and I want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Oh, Terry, thank you. I've been looking forward to it, and thanks for having me aboard Fresh Air.
Let me ask you how you first met Mingus in the 1950s.
Some friends of mine and I went out to a now-defunct club in Greenwich Village called The Pad. I had never met the man, never seen him in person or anything. I heard a record that a friend played for me. I think it was with Red Narvo. And I said, man, who is that bass player? He said, a cat named Charles Mingus. Said, well, he sure is bad. Pardon me. So we ventured down to the pad. I think it was on a Saturday night. And by the time we were seated, Mingus was getting ready to play his theme song, which I think you know, Terry, it's Cherokee. And naturally, 20 years ago, he played it triple fast. And as soon as they had played maybe the first 8 or 16 bars, he stopped the band and said, oh man, I sure wish I could get a drummer who could keep time and play fast. And Lou Donaldson happened to be in the house because I had spoken to him prior to our getting a table. And he said, my homeboy can do it. And I was saying, oh man, why would he do that? Mind you, I had only been playing drums for 6 months at that time.
Oh, really?
That's right. I aspired to become a tenor saxophonist. And I'm not sorry that I started on the tenor, because it finally turned to where I thought in terms of melodic drums. But anyway, he said, well, tell him to come on up. So the cat said, go ahead, man, you know, can't lose anything. So I went on the bandstand. And it seemed to me, Terry, that this time when he kicked the tune off, it sounded four times as fast. Anyway, I struggled through it, through the solos from the sidemen, the piano. Then Mingus said, you got it. And I played it something. I don't even have the slightest idea as to what it was then. But I was able to get through the tune. And as soon as we finished, Mingus said, I want to see you. And we went over in the corner, and he told me that he was really drugged with the cat that was playing. And he liked the way I sounded, that it seemed that I had a natural swing. And I was afraid to even mention the fact that I had been playing only 6 months, that I had never had a book nor a teacher or an instructor of any kind, that I was kind of just playing the drums on the side, you know? At any rate, he said, we're going to have rehearsal Monday. You can think it over. And if you reach a decision, let me know. Rehearsal will be at 3 o'clock. Monday at 3, I was there, and it was the beginning of a wealth of knowledge, friendship, worldwide travels, and many, many other things that I doubt that I could have achieved had I not made that decision to join Charles then.
Who else was in the band when you first joined?
Willie Jones was on drums. I think Mal Waldron on piano, George Barrow on tenor saxophone, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the other musicians, but I do remember it was a sextet that he was using at that time. But mind you, when I got to the rehearsal, it was an altogether different band. It was not the same cats at all. And I said, wow. It seems that maybe for that particular engagement, he had hired the musicians that he was using just for that. And at the end, they all knew that it was going to be over. Now, I'm just guessing at that, Terry.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
What did, what were your first reactions to Mingus when you worked with his group? Ted Kersen spoke to us on Fresh Air, and he said that when he was playing with Mingus, he always felt you had to keep one eye on Mingus because he was so unpredictable and so volatile sometimes that you never knew what he'd do. Of course, he joined, as he put it, right after Mingus had knocked out all of Jackie McLean's teeth.
Well, I was, pardon me, I was just awed by the fact that, first of all, I had never played with any name. Of course, I was very, very young, just out of high school and everything. And I was just fascinated over everything that was going down. For instance, at the first rehearsal, I can remember this very, very distinctly. We were in a sort of circle, and my older brother had told me that this was really quite an opportunity for me, and that I should be always aware of everything that was going down around me, you know? So, as I was saying, we were sort of in a circle, and Mingus was at the piano. And he said, okay, I want the saxophone to play this. And he played the line. And at the same time, I remember Wade Leggy was the pianist. And he said, Wade, you will reinforce the line by playing the same thing on the piano. And the trumpet player pulled out a piece of manuscript to get ready to write it down. And Mingus said, no, man. No writing the music. Just memorize it as I play it for you. And he said, now, Danny, your thing will be pulsation and to enhance the thing that the soloist will be doing after we play the line. I forgot who asked, why not write it down, because it would make it much easier to just read it. And he said, no. It's not the notes so much that I'm interested in. I want a certain interpretation of the notes. And I knew then that I was really getting prepared for a school of music and thoughts from this individual that I had never encountered before. And throughout our long relationship, it was always things like this that went down, you know?
Was it always that way, Danny, even for, like, you know, the pieces that had, you know, an orchestration for a lot of instruments? Like in the cumbia and jazz fusion work, where there's, you know, really a lot of musicians on
right.
on the set. Did he just sing the parts to everybody?
No. He had a theory that if the small band learned the music first, which we did, and then when he brought in all of the other musicians, it was sort of like this, Terry. The saxophone player had the responsibility to explain certain passages in the music to all of the rest of the saxophones. The same for the trumpet. And the pianist would help out as far as maybe if they're in like cumbia, there were three or four guitar players, and the studio was set up such that different sections were all together. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, Mingus, being the person that he, I almost said is, and I really don't like to say was, and I think you understand.
Yeah.
I've seen him spread himself out. Let's say you have a sandwich and you love mustard, and you're going from side to side, top to bottom. I've seen him do this very, very effectively in conveying to every musician exactly what he wanted, even though everything at this point was written out. I mean, like maybe 15 or 16 manuscript pages all taped together, you know? but we had already experienced this type of thing long before. I should say that Charles and I had, because I think back to Half Mass Inhibitions, which was a large group, then the all brass ensemble with only one saxophone, which was Charles McPherson. Then Let My Children Hear Music, which was really star-studded, you know. I would just like to reflect on that just a moment, Terry. You know, when you have musicians of that caliber on a recording session, my first thought was that, I said, well, man, wow, here I am finally with an opportunity to play with all of these, I mean, everybody there was a band leader in their own right, so to speak. And I say, well, this is going to be some very hard and intricate music to play, and I want to see just how they're going to handle it. But I don't think that the caliber of musicians that are assembled here, there won't be any mistakes made. If they are, then it will be me making them. So from that, I just said to myself, well, I will have to be on my very, very best so that I will be like them and not make any mistakes too. Even then, it was still a learning process for me,
mm-hmm.
because Charles would always invariably come up with something new that he would ask of some of these musicians who were playing in the jazz workshop.
There were frequently a lot of time changes in Mingus's music. Did he ever, like, talk with you about how he wanted you to handle a time change in the middle of a piece?
Oh, yes. Many, many times, Terry. The one that is most outstanding for me, he said, look, Danny, we were in a place called Half Note, and they had candles on the table, nice tablecloths and everything. And he took the candle and just put the holder on the floor. And he said, okay, when we get to this certain passage, by the time we start playing, he said, you'll be in the center. So he made some wax and made a dot in the center of the table. And he said, imagine that it's a graph and we're going round and round. And he said, you go around until finally it expands, you get larger and larger and larger until we have reached the peak musically that it can't go beyond that. Everybody has done what they're supposed to do. He said, now at that point, what you have to remember is that where we stop, and you will be the one responsible for all of the cues that go down in every piece that we play. He said, actually, you are the band leader. You know, I said, oh, Charles. He said, okay, now at this point, just take the graph and go back the same way that you came until finally you get back to this dot. And that did more for me and my playing. And not only that, just about having conversations with people, how things go down. I mean, you say, if you meet someone, you say, hello, first of all. You just don't start talking. And the same thing was in his music. And there was, at some time or another, this graph always present in most of the things that we played.
You mentioned, you know, like waiting till the soloists kind of hit their peak and then starting to revolve around again. There were such really high peaks on so many of the sessions that Mingus led. It really seemed that a lot of the musicians really took just incredibly inspired solos when Mingus was there. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the things that he would do to just, like, really provoke musicians into doing their absolute best? People have also often talked about how Mingus kind of taught them to play at the far edges of their instrument, to really explore all the possibilities of it.
There were so many different things, Terry. One thing I remember, and I thought it was really out, when he first asked Curtis Porter to take his mouthpiece off of his horn and start very, very softly and finally, you know, hook it all up together and then start playing. But as far as getting the best from the different musicians that were in and out of the jazz workshop, I found that his principle was to always mention Charles Parker in saying that the best solos that he ever took did not last for over two choruses. And I think you know exactly what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you can do the very same thing. At the same time, it doesn't mean that you have to come with a flurry of notes and shoot your wad all at one time. And that was one of his favorite expressions, you know. And it seemed just like the difference in night and day that the musicians were able to understand exactly what he meant, in that I can remember that one of the conversations would be centered around, he said, man, you have to play the same way you talk. You don't just come up and say, man, how are you today? Everything's fine. I'm going to the movie. You know what I mean? He says, it's never like that. You have to make a definite expression first and build around that. And he said, don't worry. Like, we'll give you time to always be able to do that. But think of it as if it were a conversation. And it was different things like that, Terry, that got the best from all of the side men that came into the jazz workshop.
Another quality of working with Mingus that has been mentioned by many musicians is his temper and his, you know, kind of like changeable presence. Did that ever become difficult for you, or do you think that a lot of that has just become jazz myth and has been exaggerated over the years?
I think most definitely it's been exaggerated. I do know that the man wanted his music played a certain way, and he wanted it played correctly. And when this did not happen, sure, he would stop the band and point out the correct notes that should have been played, and we'd start over again. Mind you, I've gotten some of the same kind of treatment when I didn't bring the band up to the peak where it was supposed to have been thunder and lightning, you know, and not and not like a little boy trying to sneak in the back door and not be seen. He says, man, we want to see and hear you. So that, as I was saying that, I got some of that too. But I think primarily it was only because he wanted a certain thing. And it was just his manner in which he got these things done that turned everybody off, the way I see it. Because I tell you, quite frankly, that Charles was really a very, very sweet man, and was always saying, you know, man, I love you. It really doesn't matter too much what you think of me, but if we can see eye to eye on certain things and the music is played right, you can benefit as much as I can. And I remember also, he said, what I want and where my responsibility is that you play the music. The solos are your responsibility. And that made a lot of sense to me. And I think that when he kind of shifted the whole scene around in terms of saying that when you play a solo and it's going to be stated who's playing it, that this was the incentive to make the cats play on their very best at all times, you know?
Mm-hmm. on one of the albums on Candid, one of the Jazz Workshop albums with yourself and Dolphy and Ted Kirson. Some of the tunes, although they're in the studio, are introduced by Mingus on the introduction to Fables of Phobos. Although it's in the studio, he says, please don't ring the cash register, and please no applause.
Yeah, no glasses tinkling.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, do you remember that session and like why he was saying that in the recording studio? And is that an accurate representation of what bothered him in clubs?
Oh, yeah. Terry, it was almost like last week in that Mingus had been made fantastic promises by a lot of record companies, and the very last club that we were playing in during the time that the recording was made was a place called the Showplace, another defunct jazz club in New York City. At any rate, prior to this club, there had been also promises that Charles could stay as long as he wanted to, build the club, and I think if you've done some research, you'll know that after that, there were, the Half Note, Pookie's Pub, the Showplace, and the Five Spot, that finally, Charles could say, well, this is home. But before that time, it was really, really bad scenes happening. The club owners were talking about the bread wasn't right, or there was something in the royalty statements that were not correct. As a result of so many things that was happening like that, especially about the club owners, that Charles decided to make it appear that we were in a club, but that he was the boss and that the audience was going to do like he said. I can remember, too, during our stay at the Showplace, Mingus had become very, very concerned that no one was really listening to what he was saying, let alone to what he was playing. And some people seemed to think that he just did this all off the top of his head, which is untrue. This was all planned as a result of certain things that had happened prior to this recording. I'd like very much to know, since you're going to have Nat Hentoff on later on this week, he was at this session, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know what his thoughts were about it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you a call after we talk with him. And
I'd love to know.
Let you know what his response to that is. So many, Mingus was one of the few jazz musicians, I think, who never seemed to really be influenced by big commercial trends. I mean,
right.
Mingus's groups always, followed a certain procession of musical thought, and it was, the compositions Mingus was writing, but if disco was selling, he wasn't going to be making disco disco jazz compositions, and if, he just didn't follow trends. Was he ever pressured by record companies to do that? To follow trends and to make things that could, stand a better chance of becoming top-selling records.
Right. I think, now I'm not certain, but I think when Mingus was signed by Columbia, that they wanted him to do, and I can't even think of the exact trend of music that was happening during that period, but that was part of the reason that he split from Columbia. I know that for a fact, because they were talking about large groups, but not having the dissonant sounds that he had in some of his music, and to perhaps stop the collective improvisation, especially if it was a large group like 30 musicians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he just would not have it. And all he needed was one thing to go down that Columbia would be responsible for to cause him to split. And I understand that after we did the series of recordings for them, that he did, in fact, leave. And I think he still had perhaps two more years on that contract. But not any real pressure, because the Mingus mystique was very, very prevalent at that time, in my opinion. I can think very distinctly about an incident at Bethlehem Records, which was not about any pressure, but about the bread. So Charles and I went to the Bethlehem office, and we just sat there. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name behind the desk, but he looked as if the mafia had walked in. Really. And we didn't say one word. We just sat there. And Mingus said, "Well, what are we going to do?" In that kind of tone like that. And, now before we go up there, he had one of the Chinese-type fingernail files that come out of the bamboo. You know the kind I'm talking about, Terry?
A fingernail file?
It's like a knife, but it comes out of two pieces of bamboo, and it's about 12 inches long.
Anyway, I think I know what you mean.
He slipped this to me, and he said, "Yeah, D, now, get up here." He said, "Start cleaning your fingernails with this." So after we sat for about 10 minutes, I took the fingernail file out, and I started cleaning my fingernails. And Charles said, "Well, what are we going to do?" And I remember the cat said, "Mr. Mingus, we're trying to get all of the statements and everything straightened out. Now, do you want that I should write you a check, or do you want cash right now?" He said, "But we don't have the cash. I will have to go and get it." He said, "Let's go." Just straight out like that. I'm trying to think of how many labels that Mingus has recorded on. And we have talked many, many times for long lengths about many subjects, which would also be about the record companies. Now, he hasn't shown it to me on paper in black and white, but he has said that not one of the companies treated him right, except Atlantic Records. One case in particular, we were asked to do sort of like an underground recording on the last tour that we did in Europe. And Mingus said, "No way." And I mean for big bread. And the record company owner was saying, "Well, Charles, listen, say, just make the record." And he say, "We will draw up the necessary papers that this record will be put on the shelf for, if you say, 12 years and then release it, that's the way it'll be." But Charles wouldn't do it. He said, "Atlantic has done right by me and has been the only company to do so, and I'm going to do right by them."
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. As he got older, Terry, I noticed a vast change in Charles. When I rejoined the band after playing rock and roll for about 5 years, and a lot of people think that I was with Charles for that whole duration from start up until now, but there were times when I was doing other things, especially when Charles went into semi-retirement. At any rate, pardon me, when I rejoined the band, I noticed that he was playing on a stool. He was sitting down, and he wouldn't announce any of the tunes that we were playing, nor would he introduce any of the musicians. And he looked as if he was just tired and not beaten, but just like you say, all later for it, you know? And I thought back to the time when Charles was very, very concerned, as I was saying before, about people not listening to the music, or especially to his bass solos. And I remember that Eric Dolphy said, "Charles, you need to start playing your solos, man." He said, "You know, the people want to hear you." So I just kind of took that same thing, and I said, "Mingus, you know, it's not going to really go down like this, man." And mind you, Terry, I know, and a lot of people don't, that Charles loved to laugh. And I tried to make it a point to keep him in stitches, you know. And so I tried to jokingly say, I said, "Listen, man, I said, people don't want to come in here and see you sitting down, man, you know, like that." I said, "No, D." I said, "No, man, you got to get up from there, Jack, you know, putting it down like that." I said, "Man, and they want to hear you say something." I said, "You can't get up there and be talking about doing the thing to my mumbles or something." And that was very funny to him. "You think so, D?" I said, "Man, I know so." You know, and I say, "It wouldn't hurt if you would let the people know who's in the band." And from that day until our very last performance, I've seen, even though there were nights he didn't feel like it, but he would at least do that. And he's never sat down to play since that day. Naturally, I feel gassed about that.
Right, yeah. Listen, which are some of the records that are, you know, your favorite sessions?
The Candid series, Terry. Dolphy. Half-Mast Inhibition on Mercury. I don't even think you can buy it anymore. Part of the Columbia series, Let My Children Hear Music. Mingus Ah-Um with John Handy and Horace Parlin. I've forgotten all of the cats that were there. And it's not strange when I think of it, because I know that there was definitely a magical thing that goes, in my opinion, beyond clairvoyance that Charles and I had. And I'm just trying to say that I think his perception was even stronger than mine, in that he felt something was wrong when he started writing these last three pieces for the albums that we did. And I don't know, for the most part, a lot of people are not even aware, because the album has not been released yet, but Charles does not play on any of them. But he knew that time was getting short, and I guess it's something that geniuses have, that permit them to do their very, very best in a very short period of time. Because in my opinion, the last things that he did were some of the very best that I've ever heard him do. One that's going to be released in maybe a couple of weeks, Terry, and I thought that perhaps Atlantic had sent you an advanced copy or tape of one of the pieces that will be in. There's enough material for, I know, three albums, but the one that they're going to open with is called Three Worlds of Drums, that start from the very beginning and and bring not only the drums, but the whole scope of music from, let's say, Baby Dodds up to the present time. And I think when you hear it, you will agree that it is one of the baddest things that he's composed. And I include that as one of my favorites.
Okay. Let me ask you there. With the exception of the periods when you left the band, you were with Mingus for a very long time, longer than any other musician by far.
Right.
What are some of the things that kept you with Mingus for that long?
At first, it was one statement that he made that was a gaffe. And I had no idea that what I was doing, as far as the music was concerned, had that kind of impact on a man like Charles. When he simply said, well, if Danny Richmond isn't there, I won't use any drums. And at that point in time, I saw the need to continue the tutorage, the lessons that I was receiving concerning life and just being associated with a person like Charles. Mind you, we've had troubled times ourselves. But when I think about it, Terry, your question, you know, it seems that it would be one of two things in a person. Either a person that was totally submissive or a person with at least a strong will to be able to encounter and deal with certain things that went down during my stay with Charles and the Jazz Workshop. I would just like to say that perhaps it was some of both, but more the strong-willed side than submission.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, for the most part, all of the musicians that have been associated with him have been totally musically submissive in order to do the things that he wanted of certain individuals. But as time went on, I saw the need of the man being very disturbed and drugged, disillusioned, and more than anything else, needed love and a friend. And since I knew some of him, I tried in my little way to contribute in any of the facets that I've just named as much as I possibly could. And then I saw that there was a dependence. I mean, there would be at sometimes 20 and 30 people around, and Mingus would say, Danny! You know, that's the way he always called, you know? And I mean, regardless of what I was doing or who I was with, that call meant that I had to see what was going on. And it's happened all over the world. So I felt that, and I mean, now, you know, time is just moving on and on and on and on. And until it got to the point where Charles said, you don't know it. He said, but all this time, I've been grooming you to be a band leader. I said, is that right, Charles? He said, that's right. He said, one day, you'll dig it. He said, that's all I'm going to say about it. And that was all he said. And then it got to the point now, because a lot of time had passed, plus I was now playing rock and roll, and then rejoining the band in the last 5 years, that I really saw the need that I mean, I think I've already said that I've seen that he was not broken by any means, and I don't want to use that word. I'm just trying to get you to see what I saw, and that there was a definite need for someone to give him the lift and to say the kind of things that he not only wanted to hear, but that he needed. You see what I mean, Terry?
Yeah. Listen, we're just about out of time. You will be leading some music soon on February 6th. I know in the past you've led some concerts of Mingus's music. What are the plans for February 6th in New York?
Max Gordon, the owner of the Vanguard, Village Vanguard, called. He said, Danny, will you be busy then? I said, no. What about the rest of the band? I said, I can get them together. He said, okay. Don't make any plans. We're going to do a special memorial for Charles the entire week at the Vanguard. I have been just kind of waiting around to see if there was going to be other benefits or memorials for Charles next week. I've been told that everyone is waiting for his wife to return. I don't know if she's in India or Mexico City or in Woodstock. Nobody knows. She's just in seclusion at this time. But on her return, I'm sure that there will be many, many things that will be going down to honor Charles's memory. But hopefully, after we do the week at the Vanguard, I've spoken to two people at two different record companies, and we're supposed to record and hopefully set a tour up. I'd like to go around the world again, for that matter, and say Danny Richmond plays Charles Mingus, because the man's name might be forgotten, but in my opinion, I think that the music will live forever.
Well, I certainly agree about that. Danny Richmond, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very kindly, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye now, and thanks again.
All right. I'll see you in Philly.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been on the telephone with Danny Richmond, who spent, I guess, over or about 20 years as the drummer with Charles Mingus's band, and he spoke to us from his home in Greensville, North Carolina. He, as you heard, knew Charles Mingus very well and performed with him and recorded with him a great deal. When I asked Danny Richmond what some of his favorite recording sessions with Mingus were, he mentioned one of the Jazz Workshop albums from the early 1960s on Candid Records. So we're going to hear now a selection from that session. And this is a Mingus piece called Vaseline, and it was recorded in the early 60s. We'll hear Danny Richmond on drums on this and Charles Mingus on bass. And also featured on this recording is Ted Kersen and Eric Dolphy. Thank you. a Charles Mingus composition called Vaseline, and we heard Danny Richmond, Charles Mingus, Ted Kersen, and Eric Dolphy on that recording. We're going to talk some more about Mingus Tuesday afternoon on the show at 2 o'clock when we're joined on the telephone by Nat Hentoff, who knew Mingus well, and he'll be talking to us from his office in Manhattan. Right now we're going to hear another Mingus piece, and we'll be hearing a recording of Better Get It in Your Soul. And on this session, we'll hear Mingus again on bass and Danny Richmond again on drums. Also featured John Handy, Booker Irvin, Horace Parlin, Shafi Hadi, Willie Dennis, and Jimmy Napper. Thank you. Charles Mingus is Better Get It In Your Soul. Danny Richmond was the drummer. Mingus featured on bass. And that version of it is featured on a Columbia double album, which is called Better Get It In Your Soul. Well, this is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. 8 minutes after 3 is the time. I'd like to remind you that Tuesday afternoon at 2, we'll be speaking with Nat Hentoff about Charles Mingus. Well, there is a storm watch for tonight, and the Weather Bureau is predicting 1 to 3 inches before the snow changes to sleet or freezing rain tonight. And the forecast calls for more rain tomorrow, and there is a 100% chance of precipitation this afternoon, tonight, and tomorrow. Well, at about 4 o'clock today on Fresh Air, we're going to hear a documentary on minstrel shows, and this is going to address both the political and entertainment values of the minstrel shows of the 19th century in America. Right now, we're going to hear an interview recently recorded with Robert Manning, who's the editor of the magazine Atlantic Monthly. He'll be speaking with Bernard Rubin, who is the director of the Institute of Democratic Communication, which is located at Boston University. He's the director of the Institute.
My guest, I'm very happy to say, is Robert Manning, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Robert Manning was for some years with Time magazine and was the bureau chief in London. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs in the Kennedy administration and for about 6 months into the Johnson administration. He was been with The Atlantic since 1964 as executive editor and then in 1966 editor-in-chief. Robert Manning, the Atlantic has, if there's any magazine that fits the definition of panache, it's got panache. It has got style, it's got grace, it's keeping vital and alive. And one of the things that you said at the Institute's Conference on Media Ethics intrigued me when you were on one of the panels. Somebody had mentioned that the New York Times publishes by its own propaganda